to the bar on the left-hand side. Lee was on the right-hand side. I think this place contains the original spirit of the Institute. So it's really good that you guys are here. So I want to talk about coming up with axioms or postulates for quantum theory. So really this is motivated by the question of why. Why does quantum theory have the particular form that it does? When you look at quantum theory, it's quite an odd theory. It's got Hilbert space, in fact, complex Hilbert space. It's got it's got the trace formula for calculating probabilities, all these funny rules. But why does the theory have that particular structure? John Wheeler asked the question, why the quantum? I think that's what he meant. And you can think about previous examples in physics where you might say this question was answered. So, for example, if you look at the Kepler's laws, those are very odd laws he wrote down about equal areas being swept out at equal times and so on. And it wasn't as if they were self-evident, but when Newton came along and he wrote down his equations, that sort of, in some sense, explained Kepler's laws. Actually, it did a bit more. You also were able to get the orbits of comets and or even things on parabolic orbits, and indeed all of Newtonian physics. So it's good to ask the why question. Another example that people often use is the Lorentz transformations, very odd-looking transformations coming from electromagnetism. But when you think about them in terms of Einstein's postulates, then suddenly they become a lot more natural. So a way to answer the why question is to come up with some more natural laws or postulates or axioms from which you can derive the structure of the theory. And that's a good thing to do because it gives you an understanding of the theory, but it's also a good thing to do because it may take you beyond that theory into the next theory. Here I'm thinking in particular of quantum gravity. If you know why the equations are the way they are, then you have some idea about how to go about modifying them. So that's the motivation for what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to work in an operational framework. So what do I mean by that? What I mean by that is I'm going to think of having preparations and transformations and measurements. I'm going to represent these by boxes. So here's a preparation. And you can think of this as spitting out a system. There's a system. It may pass through a transformation device. And then finally, it may impinge on some measurement device. Each of these devices, these boxes, may have some knobs on them that you can use to set the particular, in the case of the preparation, you use it to set particular preparation that you're implementing, in the case of the transformation, to set the particular transformation that you're implementing, in the case of the measurement, to choose the measurement you're implementing. So, for example, in the case of the measurement, if this was a Stern-Gerlach apparatus, the knob may be the particular angle at which you orient the measurement apparatus. If the transformation is affected by some magnetic fields, then the current setting on the solenoid that that causes those magnetic fields would be the knob setting. Also, on the measurement device, you may have some outcomes, so different possible outcomes. I've just represented them by these lines here. So, for example, with the Stern-Gerlach device, the outcomes would be that the electron is detected up here or down there. Okay. So that's a very general sort of operational framework. And here I've given you a very simplified version of it. You can think about elaborating on this tremendously. And I think there's a lot of reason to think very carefully about what you mean by operationalism in general. So this is a simplified version. So I want to go through and introduce a few basic ideas. Incidentally, I'm happy to take questions at any point. This is meant to be a very informal. I assume that's the way you do things. It's meant to be very informal. Okay, so I want to introduce the notion of state. So we imagine that associated with any preparation is a state. So the preparation prepares the system in a particular state. Okay. And we define the state to be the thing that's represented by any mathematical object that you can use to calculate the probability for any outcome of any measurement you may perform on that preparation. Here's a measurement. Here's the various outcomes. So each of these outcomes will have some probability associated with them. There are many, many, many possible measurements that you can put here. But incidentally, you can regard a transformation followed by a measurement as a measurement. So you can think of this as a measurement. So, so one way of producing measurements is to have some transformation followed by measurement operators. The state is some object that you can use to calculate the probability associated with the outcome of any measurement you may perform for that preparation. Okay. So one way of representing the state is simply to write down a very long list of probabilities where alpha labels runs over each outcome of each measurement. Okay. So this is a very long list. I should say, of course, these probabilities do not add up to one, obviously. Yes, please.
Usually we think of, we are used to thinking of states in terms of a complex vector.
Yeah, we'll get that. So we're trying to explain why quantum theory. So we need to work in a much more general framework than quantum theory so that we can explain it. If we just start with the apparatus of mathematical apparatus of quantum theory already, then we need to do that.
Yes, did you just say that the probabilities do not add up to one?
Do not. Here, because, so the reason I don't is because this is just a list of probabilities associated with every possible measurement you can perform, every outcome. So maybe the first, if this is a Stern-Gerlach apparatus, then the first two probabilities might be the probability to spin up and spin down along the z direction. The next two probabilities might be the probability to spin up and spin down along some slightly different direction, and so on, through all the directions. So this is essentially an infinite, it could work up to the resolution of your ability to set the apparatus. This is an infinite list.
So to be more specific, for every yes no question about the system, you have one probability.
Well, you can say it like that. Yeah, that's okay. Or you can say there's just probabilities associated with each outcome, which is a sort of yes no question.
Okay.
Yeah. So this one has four outcomes, and there are four probabilities for that particular setting. For a different setting, you may have five outcomes, and then you have five more probabilities and so on.
Okay. So we can measure the spinning, let's say. Yeah. And then we want to measure something completely different. That's also included in this list.
Exactly, yeah. At this stage, yeah. Okay.
Can we really make this list?
So that's the point. This is kind of really bad.
Yes.
So we don't want to work with this. So what we want to do is compress this list down to something smaller. And so what we do is use linear compression. Okay. So I'm going to write down a smaller list. Well, this is a subset of all the probabilities chosen from this very long list. and I've relabeled them 1 through k. Okay. And we choose this list in just such a way that it's possible to find an equation such that any of these probabilities in this very long list can be written as a linear sum of these probabilities. Okay, so we have this.
Please. How can if p alpha is potentially infinite, mm-hmm. and even worse, potentially uncountable, mm-hmm. how is it that we can have we can guarantee that linear compression will give us a finite?
Right. So my answer to the first so to the uncountability question, my answer is not to worry about that question. I think you couldn't actually, if this is for operations, then you couldn't have an uncountable number of measurements, at least not that you perform in a finite time.
Oh.
Okay, so I'm not going to worry about that. The resolution of your settings is always going to be limited to some extent. If you go into a laboratory and look at the things, there's polarizers, they have little settings as they rotate, and they can't actually access the continuum. So I'm not going to worry about that question. I think it's the sort of question that one probably does need to worry about at some stage in this whole kind of program. I'm not going to worry about it here. And actually, I think that also addresses, it's probably, one might as well think of this as a finite list for the same reason. I think one could worry a lot more about that kind of question. I'm not going to, because I don't think it really provides any insight at this stage. Were there more questions? Okay. So one objection might be, well, you can't do this. Well, of course, you can do it in the sense that one possibility is just that this list is as long as this list. Okay. Well, in that case, you're unfortunate. You haven't really affected any compression that the world could be like. Could be if you have any kind of physics, you have any kind of laws, then you would expect there to be a relationship between these different probabilities. Okay. So as an extreme case, you may have this list the same as this one. But if you have some laws, then you would expect there to be relationships between those. And I'll give you some examples just to make that clearer.
So what is R?
Oh, sorry. R is a vector which is associated with the measurement. Okay. So this is the preparation. This is associated with the preparation. This is the state. This is a vector which is associated with the measurement. Actually, it's associated with the measurement outcome. Okay.
Sorry. Is it okay at this point to throw away all the information about, like, you on your measuring device? You said you have settings, and then mm-hmm. each setting can generate a number of outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
Is it okay at this point to throw away the information about settings and outcomes and just have a list of yes or no questions?
What do you mean by the information about settings and outcomes?
I haven't thought about it. Like, it could be that just having a list, like, for each set, like, for each setting mm-hmm. and each, like, light bulb, you have a yes or no question. Like, mm-hmm. you know, did the light bulb turn on when I set it to this?
Yeah.
But I want to make sure it's okay to, like, mm-hmm. not, like, if I forget, like, which settings correspond, which light bulbs correspond to which.
I mean, you need to, this alpha has to, you know, if you now kind of apply, this is effectively applying decompression,
uh-huh.
this formula. You could think of this as decompression vectors. And so it has to tell you which one you're going back to. You can't lose the information about what this alpha is referring to in terms of, I mean, that's somehow recorded in your, I mean, maybe when I show you some examples, it'll be clearer. If not, then ask again. So one thing is, why linear? Why should we use it? Why not, you know, quadratic compression or some other kind of compression? Well, if you allow yourself to take arbitrary mixtures of preparations, then you can show that this has to be linear. So what I mean by an arbitrary mixture is, you toss a coin. If you get heads, you put one box here. If you get tails, you've got another box there. Okay. Then you can show. As long as you're allowed to do that, as long as your set of preparations includes mixtures of preparations, then the compression has to be linear. And that's one nice thing about doing compression in the context of a probabilistic theory. If you have a list of other kinds of physical quantities, where you didn't have that kind of argument of being able to say mixtures, then you couldn't necessarily use in an effective way linear compression.
So that assumes the linearity of probability, which assumes that everything is nice and independent, that your coin flipping is completely divorced from what's going on with your...
Let's see. It's true that if your coin was so heavy that whether it came at heads or tails, it caused the apparatus to sort of actually do one thing or another, or you probably found it. So yes, there are some sort of stuff.
Yeah, I'm not trying
to.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
I'm just trying to. No, the nitpicking is what we do. that's good.
Is there like a simple explanation for what's... So a compression scheme is just you have like some smaller state space and a big state space, and it's just a map from the small state space to the big state space.
Let me show you the example, because I think that's what we need. So I'll just go slightly up sequence here. So let me show you how it works in quantum theory. Let me take it back to qubit. So we have a spin half particle. So then the density matrix we can write down the density matrix like this. So in a particular basis, we can have the probabilities of spin up and spin down along the z direction. And then we have some off diagonal terms. Okay. And if you look at one of these off-diagonal terms, A, it's equal to, this is one thing it's equal to. We're ignoring you.
I don't.
You've disproven that already. okay, so you can just do the calculation, and this is something it's equal to. Actually, I'm not sure about that. I might have got the coefficient wrong. So that can be an exercise. fine, but there's some equation. Basically, it's a linear sum with complex coefficients in there. Of the probability of getting spin up along the x direction, the probability of getting spin up along the y direction, and these two terms for spin along the z direction. Okay. So what that means is we have the same information as we have in this list. Okay. If I give you those four probabilities, then that contains the same information as the density matrix. Not only does it contain the same information, but actually they're linearly related to each other. It came as a surprise to me, although in retrospect, this is a long time ago, it came as a surprise to me to realize that the density matrix is just linear in probabilities. You're so used to thinking that you've got amplitudes that you have to square. And you know, you're so used to working with pure states that this kind of fact is obscured. Really, you know, quantum theory isn't that radical. If you take the density matrix to be the key object, then the density matrix is linear in probabilities, and indeed it's just equivalent to a list like this. Okay. So does this kind of clarify some of your questions? No? Nope? Okay.
Can you give us an example of a nonlinear compression process?
So one thing you could do is you could just restrict yourself to pure preparations, so pure states, okay, in quantum theory. Okay. And then to not allow yourself to take mixtures, okay? Well, then you could still do linear compression, but it wouldn't be optimal. There would be a more optimal compression that was in some way nonlinear.
This is spelled out explicitly.
no, maybe we should just talk about it cover afterwards. Yeah, because I think okay. So this is the example for a qubit. I'm doing a slightly after sequence, but I also wanted to do the example for classical probability theory. So let's just take a bit. Well, in that case, you can represent the state by, say, given the probability of heads and tails in your list. Or if you have more than two outcomes, maybe, for example, you have a dice and you have the probabilities of getting 1 through 6, or you have a board that can be in one of 10 boxes, you have the probabilities of 1 through 10. In general. You have these probabilities. So here's an example where you have three, n equals three. And the probabilities have to live inside this area, actually this volume. We don't, for mathematical reasons, it's very convenient not to assume normalization, so not to assume that these probabilities have to add up to 1. Okay, but to assume they have to add up to less than equal to 1. Okay, so we assume our states are either normalized or subnormalized. So that means that you can also have a state right here at the origin, where they're all 0, and then everything goes to this plane. So that's kind of the classical picture. Then here's the quantum picture over here. If we have here we have four parameters, and I can't draw four parameters on that board. So I'm just going to draw three parameters, and now I'm going to assume that the first two add up to 1. So I'm just basically taking a slice through the diagram that I should be drawing, where P Z plus P Z minus equals 1. Okay. So if I draw this, then any idea what the shape is of allowed quantum states?
Simplex?
No. I want to plot the allowed states. The allowed states, so these things, which are also represented by these things, with this constraint, the normalized, inside this on this graph.
Sorry.
So the constraint generally is that there's lots of things happening here. Just like this list of probabilities doesn't have to add up to 1, as we said, neither does this one. Because this can be different. This is just some subset of these numbers. Indeed, in quantum theory, you know that these numbers don't add up to 1. Okay. But the first two entries do, for a normalized state. Okay. For subnormalized states, the first two entries have to add up to less than or equal to 1. One way of saying that is that this vector times the state. Sorry, let's do it like this. Has to be less than or equal to 1. And this is an R vector, which is associated with the sort of the measurement to see if you have any of the outcomes. Okay, so so the answer to the question is that the allowed states of this form sit on or inside a sphere which just fits inside this cube. These are ones. So I can't draw very well, but this is touching all the sites. Okay, and those are the allowed states. Okay, and this is just the block sphere transformed into different coordinates. It's an affine transformation on the usual on the usual coordinates that are used to represent the block sphere. Okay. So what I want to do is there's a few facts here I want to draw your attention to. Well, a few things. So one thing I want to draw your attention to is two quantities. K is the number of probabilities required in this minimal list to specify the state. And N is the maximum number of reliably distinguishable states. So in the case of a qubit, N is equal to 2. You can prepare a spin up along the z axis and spin down along the z axis state. You cannot find another state to be distinguished from those two states every time. In the classical case, for point N is 2. And again, from the general case, N is whatever N is, whatever the number of different alternatives you have are. Okay.
Yep. Can you expand a little more on what you mean by N? Because if we allow, let's say, our P vector here for the classical coin with heads or tails to have probabilities over the reals, then we could have it. And what does it mean then? I guess I'm not even sure what it means to distinguish two states in this frame.
So what I mean is, okay, so let me try to be more clear. So states are associated with preparations, and there are many possible preparations. I can choose subsets of preparations, okay, from all the possible preparations. I can choose subsets. Okay, here's a subset of preparations, three, which have the property that I can find some measurement which has outcomes. It doesn't matter how many outcomes, maybe five outcomes, such that if I send this preparation onto this measurement, it gives rise to, say, these two. If I send this one on, it gives rise only to that outcome. If I send this one, it gives these outcomes. So I can distinguish with this measurement which preparation I had. Okay. So that's a set of preparations that can be distinguished by some measurement. I want to know what's the maximum number of such preparations in the set of all preparations, considering all possible measurements. Okay. That's the definition of N.
So in the classical coin case, N would be 2?
Yeah. Yep. And in the quantum qubit case, N would be 2. Okay. So I've defined K and N. In the classical case, you can see that K is equal to N. In the quantum case, in general? Yeah, it is.
Okay.
K squared. So, yeah, almost. What is K? K is equal to N squared. K is equal to N squared. So that's nice. For the classical case, k is equal to n. For the quantum case, k is equal to n squared. Just to show you where that comes from, if I write down the general density matrix,
just go up here.
So what you can do is count the number of real parameters needed to specify a general density matrix. And that's going to be equal to k. So that's the number of real parameters you need to establish experimentally. So if you take a density matrix, k is equal to n plus, well, the numbers above the diagonal are just the complex conjugate of the numbers below, so we only need to count one. So the number of numbers above the diagonal is, well, they're all complex, but they have two real parameters in them. And then there are n times n minus 1 over 2. And that's equal to n squared. If you had real quantum theory, then you wouldn't have n squared. You'd have some other function. You'd have a 1 here. And if you had quaternionic quantum theory, then you wouldn't have a 2 here. You'd have a 4 here. So again, you'd have some other function. K wouldn't be equal to n squared in either of those cases. So that's one answer to why quantum theory should be complex.
Why does that answer the question?
Sorry? Are you guys there? No, I
don't.
Okay, okay. Yeah.
So how does it answer like quantum mechanics are so complex?
Well, and maybe I need to elaborate more on why we really want n squared. Okay. Yeah, I have a special focus to that platform. Okay. So the case I forget. So here are some postulates out of order. Postulate 3, there exists.
I'm sorry, can you tell us what postulates 1 and 2 are?
No, I will.
Okay.
Yeah, I will, yeah. This is just a label for postulates, so they don't have to be in that order. So the postulate here is that there exists a continuous reversible transformation between any pair of pure states. So if you look at these two diagrams, you can see in this case, if I want to get from here to here, there's no way to go in a continuous reversible fashion. I have to kind of jump from this point to this point. I should define what pure states are. Pure states are states that are not mixtures. On these diagrams, they're the extremal states. So in this case, the pure states are the ones on the surface. So over here, I can go continuously between any pair of pure states. Is what, sorry?
The basic object in this theory is the density matrix.
The basic object at this stage is a list of probabilities. I'm trying to obtain the density matrix as coming out of a set of postulates.
Okay, so then you really need to tell us, so you're not trying to explain to us what a pure state is in that, right?
So in that language, a pure state can be represented on a graph like this. It's an extremal state in the set of allowed states. These sets have to be convex. So pure states are states that cannot be simulated by mixtures of preparations. Is a more general operational definition. So mathematically, that corresponds to states which are extremal. In this
So in order to satisfy that postulate, we need that we have to move only three pier stays?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, because otherwise you could
just go like this, yeah. The reason for that is we're insisting that the transformation is continuous and reversible. What I mean by that is that the transformation can be made out of lots of smaller transformations, each which are as close as you want to the identity. And then your broad transformation has to be reversible. So you can show that means that each individual bit of the transformation has to be reversible. I should have said transformations in this general language. I just give them by a sort of real matrix acting on the state.
We assume that all transformations are linear, then?
They have to be linear because we've implemented linear compression.
Yeah. Okay.
There's a lot of mathematical background and I don't have time to tell you.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you can prove they have to be linear. Okay. So lots of good questions, but you've forced me to ask a sequence. So let me just check I've covered all the facts. So the next thing I want to think about is composite systems. This is where you have a preparation, and then you have two systems coming out, and you can make measurements. So my postulate for that is that's true. So if you have a composite system consisting of, let's just take an example. If you have a dice and a coin, the coin has two outcomes, the dice has six. For the composite system, you have 2 times 6. So that would be an example of this. This one is not as obvious why this should be, why this is natural. One thing it corresponds to, in fact, you can show it's equivalent to the constraint that if you have a composite system, you can establish the state by making measurements on each of the two components locally and then just calculating the correlations. Okay, so you don't need to bring the two systems together. You can do what's called local tomography. Incidentally, incidentally, you can show in general that this has to be true. The K for the composite system has to be greater than or equal to KA times KB. You can show that just under very general reasoning about these operational systems. And what that means is that quaternionic quantum theory is ruled out in these operational frameworks. Okay, so that puts an end to that story. So.
We cannot conceive of a universe where there could be quaternionic quantum theory.
I mean, obviously, there's always going to be caveats. So this is, first of all, this is for the finite dimensional kind of situation. where you have countable, where you have, where K is also a parameter. If you had continuous quantum theory, then maybe you can get around it. Secondly, what's really enforcing this is some idea that you can prepare things separately. You can make, you can prepare something over here and also prepare something over here, which is very natural in these operational theories. And I haven't given you all the background structure. You could think of really crazy situations where that wasn't the case. But I think it puts this kinds of theories into a very uncomfortable place. And so Plutonian quantum theory has KAB less than KA times KB. Real quantum theory actually has KAB strictly greater than KA times KB. And he went to Bill Wooters' colloquium a few weeks ago.
How is it that they don't allow equality at real and quaternion?
Oh, it's just the counting. If you look at this, but instead of putting a 2 here, I put a 1 or a 4.
Oh.
And I just don't know. The equation fails from here. And actually, so more generally, if I have this postulate 2 there, I also have k as a function of n, and k of n plus 1 is strictly greater than k of n. If I have those two constraints, then I can show in general that k is equal to n to the power r, and r equals 1, 2, 3, etc. K is the minimum number of probabilities required to specify the state under linear compression. I'm sorry? General states, yeah. We're assuming we can take arbitrary mixtures here. So this is interesting. The first example here is classical probability theory. The next one is quantum theory. And then there's an obvious question. Can you construct the higher ones? Okay. I spent, or I should probably say wasted, far too much time thinking about that question. Right. I should start to wrap up because I'm in danger of going over time. Postulate 1. Over here. So I call this the information postulate. Let me motivate it. If I have a classical system which has a certain a certain information carrying capacity. So this memory stick has, this is an old one, it has 512 megabytes. Well, there's a certain sense in which that is equivalent to any other memory device that has the same amount of memory capacity. Furthermore, if I restrict myself, so I only use a certain amount of this, say I only use 100 megabytes of the capacity of this, then there's a certain sense in which, under that restriction, that's equivalent to any other memory device having 100 megabytes or restricted to 100 megabytes. Also, in quantum theory, if I have a 10-dimensional Hilbert space in one physical situation, that's equivalent in a certain sense to any other situation where I have a 10-dimensional Hilbert space. Actually, it's more clear. If you take, a photon, the polarization degree of freedom of a photon, and the spin degree of freedom of an electron, then there's a mapping between those two. There's a certain sense in which they're equivalent. One can make this operationally clearer. I won't have time to do that. And also, if I take a 10-dimensional Hilbert space, but I restrict myself down to a 5-dimensional subspace, then there's a sense in which any that's equivalent to any other quantum system having a 5-dimensional sub, having restricted in that way. So here's the postulate. So systems having or constrained to have a given information carrying capacity. Have the same properties. I think it's something like this aspect of quantum theory that's driving the field of quantum information. In quantum information, you don't care what physical system your qubit is made from; it has the same properties anyway. If you have 10 qubits, the same thing. It doesn't matter what they're made from. You can use postulate one to justify these two equations. This is obvious. This is obvious. This is not so obvious. So now we're in a situation where we have three postulates. We know that we have a set of theories, r equals 1, r equals 2, r equals 3, et cetera. The simplest theory that's consistent with those postulates is the r equals 2 case. Because with the r equals 1 case, you have the simplex, and it's not possible to have a continuous reversible transformation between field states. So far, I haven't been able to rule out the higher theories. So my postulate, and you won't like it, I don't like it, is simplicity. So this says, and actually this has to be the last postulate. Here the label is significant. Postulate 4 says that we take the simplest, we take k to take the smallest value for each n that's consistent with the other three postulates. Okay. In other words, we take the smallest value of r. Just as I defined it now. Just meaning we take the simplest. I haven't written that in full. So now the claim is, with those four postulates, we can derive finite dimensional quantum theory, the basic structure. You have density matrices, you have the maps are completely positive maps. I'm not sure you've done those yet. The general structure, that you have the tensor products performing composite systems, that you have the trace rule, the basic structure that's used, say, in quantum information theory, follows from these postulates. And I won't go through the reconstruction theory. It's lengthy. I'm currently writing a paper which simplifies it, but it's still going to be 40 or 50 pages long. And that's the idea. We have a few more minutes, don't we? Any questions on that?
I must say I'm really confused about the real vector space case. Right. So in the real vector space case, you say k is greater than ka, kb by a factor of 2.
Not by a factor of 2, but... I can give you an example.
But if you actually had real vector space model, what you find is that many of the items k are equal to some other item. They're equal in pairs. And so the actual minimal number to describe a composite system would be k, a, k, b, if you took that into account.
Maybe we're thinking of different models of what you mean by real Hilbert space quantum theory. So what I mean is the density matrix is restricted to have real entries, not only on the diagonal but also up and down. You may have a different notion.
I'm thinking of the case where the if you build it out of pure states, the pure states have real coefficients.
Okay, yeah. So that's a different. Although if you take general mixtures of that, I think it's then equivalent.
No, it's not. That's what you're saying.
Well, of course, you can get some calculations, I suppose.
Yeah. So in my model, you'd never be able to realize the whole space.
You wouldn't be able to get general mixtures, is what you said. Okay, right. So yes, all my remarks are definitely within this kind of convex probabilities framework that you allow yourself. Okay, and maybe that's a good response also to the Kryptonionic case, all the work that Steve Adler did, which I never understood. Maybe one can support it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Any more? Okay. So that's sort of the main thing I wanted to. Oh yeah.
Do the higher R's, do they exist? Like, can you find?
Yeah, so I did this original work in 2001, and I've wasted far too much time. I've been trying to show that they do exist and construct explicit examples. Not just me, other people have tried to do this. A guy called Karol Tchaikovsky. I have to give you the paper because I can't spell the name. Has tried to construct them. He's sort of constructed models which don't quite agree with the postulates, are quite unnatural, but they have some sense in which they have higher arc. But no one's really constructed a natural model of that sort. Recently, I've made some progress in getting rid of the simplicity axiom.
With a different axiom?
If you add the axiom if you say that in general your the thing that plays the role of the bit at the qubit, the generalization of the bit, is a hyperspherical object, and you allow arbitrary SON transformations on there, then it's ruled out. And that's a very natural thing to do. But it's still mathematical. I'd like to give a sort of a more general physical motivation for that. It kind of fails when you start to put composite systems together. That's where you. So I think the class of theories having R greater than 3 is extremely unnatural. But there may be some interesting cases. And what would be really exciting, it would be if you could construct one of these higher theories and show that there was a restriction, that under some restriction on the states, you got the quantum case. That would be interesting because if you look at the quantum revolution, what really happened was we went from R equals 1 to R equals 2. We realized that actually all our classical physics was consistent with a constraint on the quantum theory. Basically the constraint that the density matrix is diagonal. So there does exist a constraint like this. So if you could find one of these higher theories and show there's a constraint, then it would be possible that there was another revolution, waiting to happen. So we don't, I don't believe that's the case. But that would be nice if it were the case. I think these theories are going to be inconsistent. That's my gut feeling. Just to wrap up, I think there's a few directions of research that are sort of coming out of this that I think are important. One is to really get a grip on what you mean by operationalism. And I gave you a very sort of simplified picture with boxes. I think just as a general exercise, that's quite a useful thing to do, and I've been thinking a lot about that. The mathematical structures that drop out, when you really think about that, are interesting. They connect up with work that's been done by people in the computer science department on category theory, linking category theory with quantum mechanics. I don't understand the category theory aspect of it, but they draw nice pictures, and the pictures are the same, and apparently that's all there is to category theory. And then the other direction, I think, is thinking about quantum gravity. So if you believe that the theory of quantum gravity is going to have to go beyond quantum theory, that quantum theory won't suffice, then you want to have some general mathematical structure in which you can construct new theories. And so by thinking about these general probabilistic theories, we expect a theory of quantum gravity to still be probabilistic. You may have some hope of finding a sort of mathematical framework which would be a natural arena for a theory of quantum gravity. So that's another aspect of this. And I think that's really the more important thing. In the end, these postulates by themselves are not very important. What's important is to try and make progress and go beyond the current physics to some new physics. I think that's all I have to say. Please.
Can you get to any of this by taking instead of the operational framework, like a realist framework, where you take it as an assumption that a state is, you know, physical and try to make.
Right. Okay. So there's a general sort of question here, which is, you know, this is a very operational approach to physics, and there's something deeply unsatisfactory about pursuing an operational approach. You know, if you believe that the world is sort of made out of something, and there's some sort of reality at the bottom, and you know, whatever it is, and ultimately apparatuses and everything made out of that, then it's deeply unsatisfactory to think in these terms. I've struggled a lot with this. My attitude is that operationalism is a kind of methodology. It's a way of constructing frameworks, which hopefully will give you insight and enable you to construct new frameworks. It shouldn't be an end in itself. As to whether there's some kind of correct realist approach that falls out of this, I don't think this gives you any extra insight than people already have. Perhaps it makes the many worlds picture look unnatural, perhaps not. I think in the end, any of the realist interpretations of quantum theory, which I'm sure Rob will cover at some point, are consistent with this approach. It's kind of a different way of thinking about.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you could get things like that tables in our structure by starting with the assumption that there is some
underlying, yeah.
Some underlying assumptions about states and Hilbert spaces, and then.
Do you mean mathematical assumptions or physical assumptions? Or here we have operational assumptions, pretty much.
Because it's kind of like at the intersection. It feels like you would basically start by saying, I think this mathematical object that we've been creating in the operational framework as the tool is what's real.
Right.
Let's try to see where that takes us by assuming it exists as a physical object.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a useful route to pursue. For the time being, I'm really still thinking about the operational aspect of this. Physics in the end is a messy business, and you just sort of you adopt whatever methodology you can that you think is going to give you some, help you make some progress. This is one of those approaches. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Let's thank I want to ask you, which